History Show with Moz Duncan.
Good evening. On this week's program, the Princess Grace Irish Library. We visit Monaco to hear about this oasis of Irish culture inspired by Grace Kelly's connection to Ireland. Also, Long Island and Coney Island.
New York has those, as you know, but so also does West Cork, right beside each other in Roaring Water Bay.
Ronan Kelly brings us twin tales of creativity and resourcefulness that he discovered on two of our small island communities. And to begin this evening, uncovering the fate of the disappeared over the last two centuries. For centuries, forced disappearances have been part of violent political conflict in Ireland. Those forced disappearances, as defined by international human rights law, involve the execution of enemy combatants, political opponents or civilians, and the hiding of their bodies for a political or military purpose. Usually, this is achieved by secretly burying the victims in remote or inaccessible locations. A new book looks at the history of this practice in Ireland and identifies all known victims over the last century, from the North King Street massacre in 1916 right up to 2003. Behind each of those disappearances is the story of a life cut short and of a family left searching for answers. That book, The Disappeared, Forced Disappearances in Ireland, 1798 to 1998, is written by historian Dr. Padraig Óg O'Rourke, who joins us to discuss this controversial and often harrowing topic. Padraig, you're very welcome back to The History Show.
Thanks, Miles. Good to be back.
Now, we think of this as a 20th century phenomenon, but you've traced it back to the 1790s.
It's not, yeah, it's much older. It goes right back to 1798. And again, I suppose the rebellion of that time, inspired by the French and the American revolutions, was much bigger, much more public, had many hundreds of thousands of people more involved in it than, let's say, the War of Independence and the IRA of the 1920s had. Part of the problem for the United Irishmen was that they spread so rapidly in the 1790s that they were very easily infiltrated by spies. And the United Irishmen were particularly brutal in how they dealt with spies, even by the standards of the Provisional IRA in the 70s or the so-called good old IRA in the 20s. For example, in 1795, you had a Redemptorist priest who was Father Michael Phillips. He had been giving information about rebels in Roscommon. He fled to Belfast. The United Irishmen captured him there and assassinated him. There was, in August 1795, William McCormack, a Dublin Castle agent in Wicklow, and 200 United Irishmen raided his home one night, dragged him out, cut off his ears and his nose before killing him, and then decapitated him and cut his limbs off. And as well as killing informers in a very brutal fashion, they also disappeared people in the 1790s, which is something we don't talk about. We have this slightly romanticised notion of 1798 rebellion, that it's peasants with pitchforks and pikes fighting redcoats in pitched battles. But look at incidents like David Newell, who was a United Irishman, joined in Downpatrick in 1796, was turned and became King's evidence and gave evidence against 200 United Irishmen at court hearings in Belfast. And he became what you could call an identifier. He would go out with the British in British uniform and actually pick out off the streets United Irishmen to arrest. He was paid £2,000, huge sum in those days, for his evidence. But he also decided to write a tell-all book celebrating his exploits, which was not a very bright idea. It put him at the top of the United Irishmen's hit list, and eventually they got hold of him. They abducted him, they killed him in secret, and he was buried at Temple Patrick, County Antrim, in a shallow grave where his body is still hidden.
And the United Irishmen did also disappear some of those redcoats that you were talking about as well, didn't they?
Yeah, there's numerous instances of not just informers, but British soldiers being disappeared as well in 1798. I think most people think of Wexford or Wicklow in the north, or maybe Mayo. There was, of course, action in, let's say, in West Cork and Clonakilty, the so-called Battle of the Big Cross in June of 1798. Two British soldiers who were stationed there, seeing local girls at the time, were picked up, were executed. Their bodies are buried in a field which is still known locally as the Soldier's Grave. They're still hidden there. On the Offaly-Kildare border, there's a small village, Brackna, and it was a hot summer. There was a yeomanry guy sweating in his red coat, called to a local house to ask for a glass of water. He called it the wrong house. They were rebels. He was stabbed to death. His body was buried at a crossroads, and it was only discovered during roadworks in the 1940s. And even If you look at County Cork, a place where there's a lot of disappearances later in the 1920s, Patrick Murphy, who is a weaver, joins the South Cork militia, and he, for joining up, he's seen as being a traitor, and he's executed. He's buried in the sand at Knockadoon Strand, and his body is uncovered by a high tide a few weeks later. And even my own, where I'm living at the moment in Bantir in North Cork, there was a local guy, Tom Honam, nicknamed Tom the Devil. He was a member of the infamous North Cork militia in 1798. He's reputedly the guy who invented the torture of pitch capping, which was cropping rebels' hair short and covering it with their scalp with tar and gunpowder and setting it on fire. He was captured after a battle. He was killed and he's buried in an area of Wicklow still known as Drummer's Corner. And his ghost, or his body as well as his ghost, are still reputed to be there.
And did the Crown Forces in 1798, did they bother disappearing anybody, or did they just hang them and leave the bodies there?
In a lot of cases, they're hanging and gibbeting people and leaving the bodies there. In some cases, they do disappear people as well, be it the 1798 rebellion, be it the War of Independence, be it the modern troubles in the north. The majority of those who are forcibly disappeared are always killed by the Republicans, but you do get the British doing it as well. Often in cases when the British do it, they tend to have a habit of mutilating the bodies and sometimes keeping body parts as very grim war trophies or souvenirs. There would have been a lot of mass graves that were dug at the time of those killed in battle. But also you had things like rebels being executed in Wicklow and then being thrown into the waters. And local fishermen in Wicklow actually threatened to go on strike unless the British Army stopped disposing of rebels' corpses in the Irish Sea, because their nets kept getting tangled up with these headless bodies of rebels.
So you then have 1848, you then have 1867, you have the Young Ireland Rebellion, you have the Fenian Rebellion. Now, there weren't actually that many casualties in either of those rebellions, so we're not really talking about the disappeared there.
All those rebellions are basically too short. They're a few day affairs. They're not long enough to have a campaign of disappearances.
But then in 1916, the North King Street Massacre occurs, and once again, forced disappearances become part of a conflict in Ireland. Now, the North King Street Massacre is notorious, but not many people, I think, would be aware of the fact that some of the bodies were, quote unquote, disappeared.
Yeah, I think the thing we forget about the North King Street Massacre is that it's actually the largest confirmed massacre of Irish civilians by the British Army in the 20th century. We think of things like Bloody Sunday in 1920 in Croke Park in Dublin, or Derry's Bloody Sunday in 1972. But there were actually 17 people killed during the North Street Massacre, which is much larger. And to be brief, what happens is there were very strong rebel positions in the area around North King Street in Dublin. They were basically protecting the forecourts and the advance to the GPO from what was then called the Royal Barracks and British troops who would have been coming that way. And it was very narrow tenement streets, very well barricaded. Rebels had taken over good sniping positions. And a bit like what happens at Mount Street Bridge, the British officers involved are very stubborn and insist on pushing their men through regardless of any resistance. And this results in huge casualties. They're repulsed several times. There's 14 killed. There's at least 30, possibly more, wounded. And the British only get control of the area when they send in an armoured car and the rebels flee. And then the British basically take their revenge by shooting and bayoneting to death 17 innocent civilians. Now, some of these people, when you look at their backgrounds, are actually loyalists. They're Redmondites. They had nothing to do with the rebellions. And there's two 16-year-old boys killed as part of it. But if we take the 17 people killed, 11 of them are just killed and their bodies are left in the streets or in their houses. Six of the bodies are hidden. Two of those bodies are hidden in O'Rourke's pub at 117 North King Street. You had the barman there, Patrick Beelan, and a local labourer, James Healy, who were basically robbed by the British soldiers, had their pocket watches and their monies taken, and they were shot, buried in shallow graves in the cellar, and then there were beer barrels put over their graves to conceal them. And then a few weeks later, there was the Louth Dairy, a small creamery at number 27 North King Street, and the garden was dug up and the remains of four men, Pat Lawless, Jim McCarthy, James Finnegan and Pat Hoey, were found buried in the garden. And again, if we think about it, this is the largest number in the 20th century. That's the largest number of disappearances that happen in a single day. And it's very interesting that when we had the state centenaries in 2016, there was two events we didn't commemorate, and they were the Bachelor's Walk Massacre in 1914 and the North King Street Massacre in 1916, and it appears that those were not commemorated for fear of upsetting the British at the time of Brexit, when there were political sensitivities.
And was there an acknowledgement on the part of the British or of the Crown Forces in 1916 of the North King Street Massacre?
No, most of the documents were actually classified until a few years ago. It was actually a reporter in the Guardian of Britain who got them declassified. And it's very funny to hear, funny in a dark sense, to hear Tory politicians like Liam Fox saying that the British are one of the few nations in Europe that do not have to bury their 20th century history, because in some cases that's literally what they did.
Now, at the same time as the British Crown Forces are disappearing people, this is during the War of Independence, so that does happen. The Irish Republican Army are also targeting individuals, focusing particularly on the threat or the perceived threat posed by alleged spies and informers. Can you tell us how that aspect of the conflict then leads to multiple disappearances during the War of Independence? More than 100, I think.
During the War of Independence itself, there's 94 people disappeared by the so-called good old IRA. If you include the truce period, you're talking close to 20 more, and then there's a handful of disappearances in the Civil War, which we might get to later. Basically, in the 1920s, the majority of those who were disappeared by the IRA would have been British soldiers who were captured and secretly executed and killed, RIC constables, black and tans, but in a lot of cases as well, it is civilians who are suspected of being spies for the British Crown Forces. And I suppose if you think about it, it's a guerrilla war, and the British are trying to gather information about IRA personnel, their activities, their movement, where they're storing their arms. And as the saying goes, information is ammunition. So the intelligence war is crucial in winning a campaign like that. The IRA disappear at least 94 people, as I said, in less than 3 years. Now compare that to the Northern Troubles, when the provisional IRA disappear about less than 20 people in 30 years. So the rate of disappearances was way higher in the War of Independence. And there were reasons why they disappeared them from their point of view. It was not just callous, there were practical reasons for it. The first one was to prevent reprisals. In the majority of cases, and almost 200 civilians were executed by the IRA as alleged informers. And again,
and was it not more effective to, you know, tie the note around the neck, shot by the IRA?
In most cases, in three quarters or up to 80% of cases, that was done, and the bodies were left in the street, and it was a warning to the local populace. But what happened in those cases was that the British Crown Forces would come along and sometimes burn the nearest houses or take revenge by killing local Republicans or IRA volunteers or people they'd taken prisoner. So there was a suspicion that if the IRA were to hide the bodies and the British were not aware if this British soldier or alleged British spy had been, whether they were alive or dead or they still in captivity, engaging in reprisals could jeopardise their life. There was also a very practical thing in terms of criminal law, and be it an official court case or a British court-martial, that if there's no body, there's a lack of evidence, and it is very hard to convict somebody of murder, as the British would have seen it. And there's also a tactic which the IRA use, and it's to create panic in spy networks, which is, if we shoot the informer and leave him on the street, everyone knows what happens. But if we disappear him, it may look like he's gone to ground. We can watch other people that are also suspected as well. We can see, do any of them withdraw their savings from the bank? Do any of them get a ferry ticket for England? And it's a way of trying to smoke out, for want of a better phrase.
So somebody who's dead could still technically be supplying the IRA with information.
Who knows? Exactly.
Yeah. Now, while it's mostly men who are targeted for informing during the War of Independence, there are cases in which women were executed by the IRA, were shot dead by the IRA, but also disappeared.
Yeah, I mean, at this stage, after the decade of centenaries, we've had a lot of new research into women's history and the activity of women in the revolution, and we've talked a lot about the role of coming among women in terms of gathering arms but also gathering intelligence. We know about people like Lily Mernan, who was Michael Collins' female intelligence agent in Dublin Castle.
A little gentleman.
Exactly. But what we know less about are the little gentlemen who were working on behalf of the British. And if you read British documentation, it says that women were a very useful source of information. The IRA were never quite sure how to deal with women spies because of the sexism or chivalry, if you want to call it, of the day. So the usual thing they would do is they would boycott them, try and boycott their businesses, boycott their families. Sometimes they would crop their hair off as a social shame. On other occasions, they would literally tar and feather them, pour hot tar over them and cover them in feathers from pillows and stuff. And if we look at the case of, let's say, Timothy Quinlisk, former member of Casement's German Brigade, a famous or infamous spy from the Wexford-Waterford area who was shot by the IRA in Cork. He'd been trying to track down Michael Collins. The IRA are happy to shoot him. His sister is engaged in the same kind of intelligence work, but the IRA's plan for her is to capture her and tar and feather her. They don't want to shoot a woman. And IRA General Headquarters issues a general order saying you are not allowed to shoot women as spies. They should be shamed instead. However, it does happen in at least three cases. And those three cases are Catherine Kate Carroll, who was executed in Monaghan. Now, she is a hackler. She's distilling poteen. That brings her foul of the IRA. She is not shot for being a poteen dealer. What she is shot for is she decides to get her own back in the IRA by informing the RIC about who is active in the IRA locally.
And she also tries to put all the other poteen makers out of business.
Yes, she wanted a monopoly. She is shot and she is left on the roadside with a spy label. An interesting thing in her case is that it's often claimed that she is a Protestant and that this is a sectarian thing. In fact, she's Catholic. But she isn't disappeared. There are at least two women who were disappeared by the so-called good old IRA in the War of Independence. One of them is Bridget Noble from Ardgroom near Bantry. She is suspected of giving information to the RIC. She's disappeared by the IRA in March of 1921. Her body is never recovered. Now, the British government accepts liability for her killing and awards her widower £1,500 as compensation, which is a pretty strong indication that it's as close as we will get as historians to saying she may have had involvement with the British forces. Also, there's Miss Maria Lindsay from...
Yeah, one of the most celebrated cases of the War of Independence, Maria Lindsay.
Yeah, and she gives information that basically leads to the arrest of 10 IRA volunteers at the Dripsy ambush, five of whom are later executed. And the British have no problem in coming out and saying that she is somebody who gave them information. They talk about her in the same way that they talk about Edith Cavell. In her case, the IRA shoot her, disappear her and her chauffeur. The bodies are hidden, and when there is an attempt to recover the bodies after the Civil War, the IRA are so determined that her body will not be returned that they actually exhume the bodies and move them somewhere else, or according to some accounts, destroy them so they cannot be recovered and those remains are still missing.
Now, Maria Lindsay was a Protestant. Catherine Carroll, as you say, people thought she was. She actually wasn't, but there have been claims, obviously, during the past century that the IRA used the execution of alleged spies as a pretext to carry out a sectarian campaign, an ethnic cleansing, essentially, against Protestants.
Well, that's the argument, and that's been put forward by scholars like the late Peter Hart and others, that the intelligence war by the IRA is really a sectarian murder campaign against Protestants. Now, I don't subscribe to that. My own PhD research, I think, has debunked a lot of that. And I think there's other scholars working in the regions like Dr. Andy Bielenberg in UCC, focusing on Cork, Dr. John Borgonovo in UCC as well, Dr. John O'Callaghan in Limerick, and all of them would doubt that. The figures, as I have them, are that of the close to 200 people executed during the War of Independence as alleged spies, 77% are Catholic and about 23% are Protestant. Now, this closely matches the general population at the time. So,
but not in what's now the Republic of Ireland, in fairness.
Not in what's now the Republic of Ireland. But what you do find is places like, let's say, South Armagh, where you would expect the IRA, if they were using this as a pretext to engage in sectarian killings, all of the alleged spies who were shot are actually Catholics, in some cases members of the Ancient Order of Hibernians. And what you find is the majority of those who are killed as Protestants, killed as alleged informers, are killed in Cork, in some cases in the Bandon Valley. And it's an area where the British Army themselves say Protestants in the south of Ireland didn't give us much information, with the exception of the Bandon Valley, where many did and paid the price for it. If we talk about one, let's say, person, and again, we can never be 100%, and this argument will go back and forward. To me, I think the real skeleton in the closet of the good old IRA from the 1920s isn't an anti-Protestant campaign. I think it is the disappeared. And whatever your politics, whatever your measure, according to the Geneva Convention,
if you continue to hide bodies after a conflict ends, that's a war crime, regardless of your politics.
Okay, you mentioned Cork. Obviously, Cork at the centre of both the history and the controversy surrounding the disappearances during the War of Independence. Tell us about one particular example, Knockraha.
Yeah, so Knockraha is, again, infamous because of who the local IRA leader is. So the captain of E Company in Knockraha, 4th Battalion, Cork No. 1 Brigade IRA, is a guy called Martin Curry. Curry was a founding member of Fianna Fáil. He was a Fianna Fáil councillor for many years and a Fianna Fáil TD. He lost the party nomination in 1969 to run for the Dáil again because he had been discovered taking bribes from builders. And I think you had to be pretty corrupt as a Fianna Fáil politician in the 1960s to lose the party nomination. This is long before the year of Charles Haughey. Really, Curry is, apart from being a corrupt politician, he's a self-aggrandizing fantasist. He would boast at Fianna Fáil dinner dances that I sowed oats on the bodies of British soldiers and they were good oats. So he's literally boasting about having bodies buried on his farm. But the problem is he takes so much drink and he boasts so much that the figures are constantly inflated. And at one stage he's claiming that he personally executed 35 people. Other figures are thrown around that up to 90 people were disappeared and buried in his area. Now, if that happens, you are going to have a record. Unless you are a transient, a vagrant, someone on the margins of society living as a
some of whom were executed.
Some of whom were executed. Small numbers. Chapter and that in the book. But with the exception of those people, if you are a British soldier who goes missing, your regiment's looking for you. If you are a civilian who goes missing, your family, your wife, your boss, your employer, they're all going looking for you. For example, Curry, to me, he's full of exaggeration because he claims that amongst the 35 people he executed are 16 British soldiers from the Cameron Highlander Regiment. Now, somebody should have told the Cameron Highlanders about this because I've seen their documentation and they say they're only missing two British soldiers. And by my account, one of them is executed by Curry and the other one appears to desert. When it comes to actually money being on the line and Curry applying for an IRA pension, it's not public. He hasn't had a few whiskies at a Fianna Fáil dinner. He says that just 9 people were disappeared and buried in his area. And that tallies exactly with the figures I have. And in one case, somebody who's disappeared
because
on
those pension applications have to be confirmed by others.
Exactly. So it's not just hearsay in that case. And one person who we do know is buried on Curry's farm is a guy called Michael Williams. He's an RIC constable from Stradbally in Offaly. He has the misfortune of going to stay in Cork City the night before a court case, and it's the night that Tomás McCurtain is assassinated. And the IRA, because they see him coming in from a rural station into Cork in the night, assume wrongly that he was involved in the assassination. He's picked up by the IRA during the truce. There's an element of score settling going on. He is taken to Martin Curry's farm. He's actually handed over by Sean Moylan, another founding member of the Fianna Fáil party, and he's executed. And we have pretty detailed records that I got declassified from the Department of Justice telling us exactly where on that farm Michael Williams' body is buried. And there was such controversy with Williams' relatives appealing to the Free State authorities in 1923, 1924, that it's as a result of Michael Williams' killing that a general amnesty for the War of Independence Civil War killings were brought in so that there would be no further prosecutions.
Now, not much went on in terms of disappearances, strangely enough, during the Civil War.
Yeah, if you talk about even the truce period between the War of Independence and Civil War, you get about 14 disappearances. And a lot of those are cases like Michael Williams, where there's an element of score settling, not over farms, not over personal disputes, but just people the IRA feel got away during the War of Independence. During the Civil War, the reason why there are so few disappearances, there's actually very few shootings of people as spies in general. And this is because Liam Lynch, who was Commander-in-Chief of the IRA at the time, keeps dithering about what to do with spies and informers. Initially, he says that nobody is to be shot as a spy. And then he changes his mind a few months or weeks later and says, OK, you can shoot spies, but only if they're in very bad cases and it has to be referred to me in headquarters. But don't shoot women as spies. And then he says, well, you know, maybe you can shoot people as spies in your own authority, and maybe women can be exiled. And he keeps changing it. And by the end of the Civil
totally
War...
Totally confused Republicans.
Yeah, the Republicans have loose contact with this guy at the best of time. And by the end of the Civil War, he's just saying, you're not shooting enough spies, get on with it. But very few people are actually shot, probably less than 20 as alleged informers during the war or during the Civil War. In the cases where we do have disappearances, you have two Free State soldiers, for example, who are picked up by the IRA in Tipperary, and they appear to be out on kind of a joyride in a car that they take them from the barracks without permission. The IRA decide their intelligence officers shoot them, bury them in a ditch, and cover them over with soil, and the bodies aren't found for several months.
Now, technically, the killing of Noel Lamass is after the Civil War, but it is as a consequence, I suppose, of the Civil War. But it all starts up again then after 1969 with the Troubles in Northern Ireland. How soon after the commencement of the Troubles do people begin to disappear?
I suppose in the early stages of the Northern Troubles, the Provisional IRA and the Official IRA see themselves as the inheritors or descendants of the so-called good old IRA of the 1920s. And between 1969 and 1973, they employ the same methods. So they are tarring and feathering people as spies. They are shooting people and throwing them on the street or shooting them in bars, and leaving a label, sometimes saying spy, sometimes saying tout, and that word was actually used in the War of Independence as well, on their bodies. So they're copying the same methods. Later, they stop labelling the bodies and they use graffiti, or in the 1980s, cassette recordings of alleged confessions. Disappearances are controversial at the time. For example, Patrick Duffy, who was a Provisional IRA volunteer from Derry, he was suspected of being an RUC special branch agent. He's shot. His body has disappeared into Donegal. But it creates such a stir that there's a local public backlash, and the Catholic Church and Catholic priests kick up a fuss about it. And the body is later exhumed by the IRA and left in a coffin on the border. I suppose the first case then that happens during what kicks off disappearances during the War of Independence really is the case of a guy called Joe Linsky. So Joe Linsky was from Harrogate Street in Belfast. He had initially trained as a Cistercian monk, dropped out of religious life and became a sales rep, and also joined the Provisional IRA. Now, he was nicknamed the Mad Monk. He was known as being a ladies' man, and he had an affair with the wife of a fellow Provisional IRA volunteer. And Linsky decided on a scheme to get rid of his love rival. So he sent an IRA volunteer under his command to assassinate his love rival. Shooting goes wrong, and his rival, the cuckolded husband, survives. But what happens is that because this guy is a Provisional IRA and there's been an attempt on his life, the Provisional IRA decide that this is the Stickies, the Official IRA, and that this must be the beginning of a new feud. So they go down to the Cracked Cup, which is a drinking club on the Falls Road in Belfast, and they go to shoot the place up, and they kill in the process an innocent civilian called Des Mackin. This almost ignites a feud between the Official and Provisional IRAs, and it causes a huge amount of embarrassment. So when the Provisional IRA realise what's happening, they need to get rid of Joe Linsky. And the result is that Linsky is taken south of the border, he's executed, and he's buried in a shallow grave, probably in County Meath. And he is one of the four cases where the bodies of those still disappeared after the 1998 Good Friday Agreement are still missing.
So, I mean, it's a story. It's not obviously the case of Joe Linsky specifically, but it's a story which is almost straight out of the Canova report. Tell us about, for example, one of the most celebrated or notorious still disappeared would be Captain Robert Nyrack.
Yeah, Nyrack is unusual because in the 1920s, there's a lot of British soldiers, RIC constables disappeared, and civilians who were alleged spies, whereas the Provisional IRA in the 1970s, primarily they're disappearing fellow Provisional IRA members they suspect of spying. And as you mentioned, Operation Canova and Steak Knife, we may never get to the bottom of what happened there. There is only one member of the British Crown Forces who was disappeared by the IRA at the time, and that is Captain Robert Nyrack. Nyrack was an intelligence officer. He placed a lot of faith in the fact that he had holidayed in Ireland, in actually the Connemara Gaeltacht and Spittal. He knew a bit of the Irish language. He was a Catholic. He knew Irish history well, and he felt that he knew enough about Irish culture that he could talk himself out of a difficult situation. But he took a lot of risks, despite his knowledge. He would go out maybe in one town dressed in full British Army gear on patrol, and then he would appear as disguise, pretending to be a provisional IRA in a pub maybe 8 miles away and assuming that nobody knew him from the other village. He seems to have been somewhat of a Walter Mitty type. For example, I have a photograph of him in the book. He's wearing his British Army uniform, but he's brandishing a Thompson submachine gun. Not standard British Army issue. It's something he's confiscated from the IRA. And he's actually wearing a black beret with an Easter lily pinned to it. So this guy is like LARPing or dressing up as a provisional IRA volunteer. But he's involved, it seems to be involved in some pretty sinister stuff. There's the 1975 Miami Showband massacre. And one of the Miami Showband who survives, the saxophonist Des McAlay, actually says that there was an English officer there given command. And he says that he later recognised him as Nyrac. Nyrac is abducted from the Three Steps Inn while on an intelligence operation in 1977. He's disappeared, he's taken south of the border, and he is killed. Now, the body is still missing. There is a myth about him that his body was destroyed in a meat grinder. That is complete fiction. That has been debunked by the Independent Commission for the Location of Victims' Remains. And I've actually traced that back to a similar story that was told about two RIC constables, or black and tans, who were disappeared in Tralee in 1920. They were Bright and Waters. And the story in that case was that they had been burned alive in the furnace in Tralee at the gasworks. But the fact of it is, and I have this from IRA veteran testimony, that they were buried out near Blennerville, and their bodies, like Nyrac's, are still missing today.
Now, there have been obviously campaigns, there have been numerous efforts to locate the disappeared. I suppose the most famous would it be the case of the remains of Jean McConville. How successful have those efforts been? Most of them are focused, or have been focused, on the Troubles, the Northern Troubles, not so much, for example, the War of Independence.
Well, the Independent Commission for the Location of Victims' Remains, the ICLVR, was set up after the Good Friday Agreement as an independent body tasked with recovering the remains of those who were killed during the Troubles. And I was very honoured to have the book launched by Jeff Nupfer, who was the former lead investigator with them. And previously he had gotten that job because he had actually located the bodies of some of the children killed by the Moores murders. Of the 32 people who were disappeared at during the Troubles, I think 16 to 17 of them were still missing at the time of the Good Friday Agreement, and they have recovered all but four of those bodies. So they've been exceptionally successful. However, when it comes to the War of Independence Civil War period, by my estimation, there are still somewhere in the region of 50 to 60 bodies missing. Mm. And I know, for example, the precise locations of some of those buried. And we discussed before, in 2018, my research led to the identification and recovery of the body of Private George Duff Chalmers. He was a British soldier, 2nd Battalion Royal Scots, who was executed by the IRA, buried in a bog in West Clare in 1921. And his remains were exhumed and reburied in Dublin and Grange Gorman Cemetery in 2018. And I sat down with, I was invited by Chalmers' family to the funeral service, and I sat down afterwards with two officials from the British Ministry of Defence, and I pulled out of my pocket a list and said, okay, you've got Chalmers back. Here's the list I have of the other British soldiers who are missing. Which one do you want to find next? And to say that they were shocked or horrified would be an understatement. The guys couldn't get up and leave the table quickly enough. And I said, no, that would be a matter for the Commonwealth War Graves. I've gone to the Commonwealth War Graves and said, I know where these, you know, people are buried, where their remains are. I have very accurate information. I'm a qualified historian and archaeologist. I found one body. Do you want to find them? And they said, no, that's a matter for the guards. Mm. And I went to the Gardaí and they laughed at me. There is no formal process for recovering these bodies. And in some cases, I actually have, since the book has been published, I have had maps sent to me anonymously in the mail giving credible information on where bodies are buried. And people are writing stuff like, my grandfather was the executioner. He showed me this is the location. I have had people like John Downing, the Irish Independent journalist whose grandfather, Thomas Downing, was disappeared by the IRA in Cork. We know roughly where his body is buried at Carroll's Pond in East Cork. I've had people like Eamon Grogan, whose grandfather was an RIC constable, Constable Thomas Joseph Walsh. I know where he's buried at Ringwood in Blarney. But, you know, people are coming to me as a historian. I have absolutely no power to act. All I can do is alert county archaeologists and Gardaí and hope they take action. And to date, there is a complete lack of political will, because I think there's a lot of political capital to be made by establishment politicians criticising the past of the Provisional Republicans in Sinn Féin. And in a lot of cases, they are right to criticise them. But the spectre of the disappeared comes up quite a lot. But if we start bringing up the bodies of people like Bridget Noble, of people like Mary Lindsay, it starts to tarnish the reputation of the founders of the state and our founding fathers and the so-called good old IRA, and it becomes politically very difficult.
Absolutely. I could point them in the direction of a couple of bodies myself, but it's not going to happen. We know it's not going to happen. Dr. Porrigog O'Rourke, many thanks for joining us on the History Show this evening. The book is called The Disappeared, Forced Disappearances in Ireland, 1798 to 1998. It's published by Merrion Press. After the break, we'll be visiting the Princess Grace Irish Library in Monaco, where Flora McCarthy met with the reigning monarch, Prince Albert II. Stay with us. Welcome back. High up, on a rocky outcrop overlooking the Principality of Monaco, sits a small oasis of Irish culture, the Princess Grace Irish Library. Named for Grace Kelly, the iconic American actress turned royal luminary, it was founded in 1984 by Prince Rainier, as a tribute to his late wife and her enduring attachment to Ireland. Grace had roots in County Mayo, where her paternal grandfather was born. This royal couple and their children, Princess Caroline and Prince Albert, made a state visit to Ireland in 1961. To mark the 40th anniversary of the library, Flora McCarthy, who was writer-in-residence there last month, brought us this report in which she speaks to the current monarch, Prince Albert II, about his family's determination to nurture cultural links between Ireland and Monaco.
Students from the Prince Rainier Academy of Music warming up as they await the arrival of Princess Caroline. She's attending the 40th anniversary celebrations at the library, and it's a special night, bringing her right back to 1961 and her parents' state visit to Ireland.
And there she is, Princess Grace, followed down the gangway by Prince Rainier, and the crowd on the balconies are waving handkerchiefs in the air and cheering. Well, now, the Taoiseach, Mr. Lamass, goes over to greet the visitors with the Minister for External Affairs, Mr. Frank Aiken. I can see the Lord Mayor of Dublin, too.
This was the first ever state visit to Ireland and made international headlines 2 years before the visit by US President John F. Kennedy. With no Irish TV channel yet, the pictures on radio had to be colourful.
And now I'll hand you over to Petronilla O'Flanagan, who is standing much higher than I and who can see more from here.
Yes, indeed. And I've had a wonderful view of a beautiful, happy, radiant girl who has just put her foot for the first time on Irish soil, and very pleased she looks about it. Her dress, a two-piece woolen, is of Kelly green.
Such was the frenzy to catch a glimpse of Grace. Huge crowds caused a crush outside the Gresham Hotel as she and Rainier arrived for the Dublin Arts Festival banquet.
She's sitting on the sofa now, exchanging notes with Mrs. Lemaire and Mrs. Aiken, and her main preoccupation is for the people outside. She's just seen one poor child nearly fainting, and there's a policeman holding her, and Mr. Aiken is telling her that he thinks everything will be all right, but they have had a very frightening experience, but it's all over now, and she's sipping champagne.
But with 3 days of formal events over, the Grimaldis took some family time in the west of Ireland, staying at Ashford Castle and visiting the Kelly ancestral home near Newport. For Grace, it would be the first of several visits to Mayo.
It's really hard to express how we feel over our visit. It's been simply wonderful in every way. People have been so warm and so enthusiastic, and we've been deeply touched by that. Even driving down yesterday, all along the road, people were greeting us, and really, it was wonderful.
I think it's wonderful. I enjoy it immensely, even with a slight difference in weather and temperature. I think it's a very attaching country. and very beautiful, and it has something which lacks for us in the coast of the Mediterranean, is it's very green.
Back at the Princess Grace Irish Library, I present my research on Ireland-Monaco links to an audience of Irish residents, local dignitaries and Princess Caroline. We hear the story of Babbling Brook, the Irish pony sent by Eamon de Valera as a gift for the Grimaldi children after their Irish visit. And we hear readings of letters between the 79-year-old president and the 5-year-old princess.
Dear sir, thank you. Love, Caroline.
Prince Albert too recalls the Irish ponies he learned to ride as a child.
In fact, there's a Christmas card, this is in the early 70s, it must have been 12 or 13, where, you know, the picture of my sisters and myself, and I'm in my cowboy outfit and riding Trixie. And so she was a wonderful Irish pony.
Sitting in what was Princess Grace's palace drawing room with its panoramic views over the Mediterranean, Monaco's reigning monarch tells me that since the 50th anniversary of his parents' state visit, he's been to Ireland almost every year.
For different reasons, sometimes for exciting rugby weekends, but also for different charity events, different cultural events. Over the years, I've been very proud of my Irish heritage through my mother and through that side of the family. And I'm very happy to have had that the opportunity to reconnect with Ireland on many an occasion.
In a testament to his interest in Irish history and heritage, Prince Albert has donated €1 million to the restoration of the Long Room at Trinity College Dublin. He's taken his wife, Princess Charlene, and their 11-year-old twins, Princess Gabriella and Prince Jacques, to Ireland, and they're regular visitors to the Princess Grace Irish Library.
Oh, I think the library is absolutely essential in keeping those links alive, because it's a cultural centre, but it's, of course, it harbours my mother's collection of books and songs and other manuscripts and anything to do with Irish culture. And I think it's just been a remarkable voyage, and my family and I have been so happy and thrilled to be able to accompany the Princess Grace Irish Library on this voyage.
Among the library's treasures are a first edition of Ulysses, a facsimile of the Book of Kells, and W.B. Yeats' memorabilia. And nearby, the Palace Archives has more, as its director, Thomas Fouilleron, showed me.
Yes, we have Irish materials in the archives, mainly about travel of Princess Grace and Prince Rainier in 1961, a wonderful trip. And lots of pictures, of course, lots of memories.
President de Valera, accompanied by the Cornister, Mr. Sean McEntee. Now, Princess Grace is shaking hands with Mrs. Lamas. And I think perhaps this would be a good time, Joan, for you to come in and describe that very beautiful dress that Princess Grace is wearing.
She is a truly dazzling figure. Her blonde hair is swept up in a formal coiffure right up on top of her stately head. And now she's sitting down. Her gown is spreading stiff embroidered folds around her. It's shimmering pinky gold is the nearest I can get to it from here, I'm afraid, and she's wearing long white gloves.
There are dozens of files here on Princess Grace's visit to Ireland and correspondence with everyone from her Irish cousins to Alfred Hitchcock. I'm researching these thanks to the Ireland Funds Monaco, who twice a year fund a writer in residence to spend a month at the Princess Grace Irish Library. This year's lucky recipients also get to be part of the library's 40th anniversary programme. As director Paula Farquharson explained, 2024 will be their busiest year yet.
We have a collaboration with TU Dublin and the local Monaco Conservatory here. So the students have been learning how to perform on the harp and other instruments. So we also have a lineup of some extraordinary speakers and writers.
And the youngest visitors won't be forgotten. Géraldine Lance and her team of volunteers at the library make sure of that.
Je suis fière d'avoir créé un petit livre vraiment avec l'esprit irlandais.
40 years after the foundation of the Princess Grace Irish Library, Irish culture is now in the curriculum of the schools in Monaco.
We love Ireland!
A definite welcome, a real capable of fortune that the people gave her, not because she was Princess Grace, but because she's returning to her own country.
Flor McCarthy was reporting there from the Princess Grace Irish Library in Monaco, celebrating its 40th anniversary this year. After the break, we visit Long Island and Coney Island, but perhaps not the ones you think. Finally tonight, Roland Kelly has been island hopping, and he encountered two men with an eye for potential that's hiding in plain sight.
Long Island and Coney Island. New York has those, as you know, but so also does West Cork. Right beside each other in Roaring Water Bay, and both of them have two curious men I came across, both named Michael. One had a bizarre boat, and one had a genius stamp idea. The Michael with the boat was on Coney Island. When I landed up on the gravel beach, he was there and we got chatting. "Come here and I'll show you something," he said. And just up off the beach, behind some bushes and trees, he showed me this huge orange cylinder, flat on one end and rounded at the other. The flat end had a door big enough for you to get in and out, and inside, along each side, were benches. This, he explained, was an escape pod from a North Sea oil rig. The way it worked was, if there was an emergency, everyone jumped in. The door was sealed and the pod was launched out into the sea. Whatever way it hit the waves, because of its design, it would right itself, and those inside would be safe from fires or explosions on the oil rig. Maybe it's the same in other countries, but if you travel around Ireland, you'll know there's nothing surprising in what people keep in their barns or back gardens. I once met a man in Westmeath who had 14 sheds full of books at the back of his house, and another man in Louth who had a bus that ran on a rail track at the back of his. So Michael, with his big orange escape pod on Coney Island in West Cork, was fascinating, but not totally surprising. Michael said he had no real plan for the orange pod when he saw it for sale. It just caught his fancy. The other Michael on the other island, just across the sound from Coney Island, Long Island, he did have a plan, as he explained to me when my boat landed on his island. The Michael on Long Island is the stamp man, and we started talking outside his cottage one evening. He invited me in for a cup of tea, and he explained to me that he was a dealer in rare stamps. Not only that, he nearly had some of the world's rarest stamps right there on Long Island, 50 years ago. In 1972, the story goes, the Department of Posts and Telegraphs gave the 300 people living on Long Island permission to have their own postal service to carry letters to the mainland 800 metres away. Michael realised that this would mean that the island could have its own stamps and that these would be a valuable rarity. He had a set of four stamps printed, with the values 4p, 6p, 12p and 15p, and with local scenes on them, like images from Long Island and a picture of the nearby Fastnet Lighthouse. Then Michael prepared 1,000 first day covers to send to collectors all over the world on the day the new service was launched. That was April 24th, 1973. The first letters from the new Long Island post office were sent to the local sorting office in Skibbereen. Once Michael's first day covers were franked there, they would attain their rare value. However, the post office rule at the time was that no one was allowed to go home from the sorting office until all posts had been sorted and sent on to Cork. Usually about 15 letters came in from Long Island, but this evening, in April 1973, over 1,000 came in, mostly the stamp dealers' first day covers, obviously. The staff in Skibbereen didn't know what to do with the 1,000 letters, and so they rang Dublin for guidance. Dublin came back saying they could find no actual record of any official permission to process any post with the new Long Island stamps. They instructed Skibbereen not to send the post on to Cork, and so Michael's great plan came unstuck. The Long Island stamps are still around though. If you go online, you can find them on Michael's own stamp dealing site for between £125 and £400. You can also find the oil rig escape pod online that I saw on Coney Island. Although it's not orange anymore, it's yellow. Michael from Coney Island sold it to a glamping site owner in Monaghan who resprayed it and modified it, so that it now looks like the Beatles' Yellow Submarine. Coney Island Michael's Pod is now a novel overnight accommodation on the banks of the Dromore River in Monaghan. So, Coney Island and Long Island in West Cork. Not as big or as flashy as their New York namesakes, but in their own small ways, compelling enough.
And that's Ronan Kelly with those twin tales from Roaring Water Bay in West Cork. That's all we've time for on this evening's programme. Details of all our items, as well as podcasts, are available on our website, rte.ie/historyshow. My thanks tonight to Harry Bookless on sound and our researcher, Ian Kennelly. The History Show is a Pegasus production for RTE. For now, from me, Miles Dungan, and producer, Lorcan Clancy, goodbye and thanks for listening.